You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, April 12th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history at the University of Chicago, author of The Next Shift, The Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare in Rust Belt America, Gabriel Winnett will be here. Meanwhile, COVID continues to surge various places across the country, particularly in Michigan. Now we have competing stories over vaccine supply. Meanwhile, Iran nuclear site hit by alleged Israeli sabotage happening aimed at perhaps scuttling or complicating U.S. negotiations with Iran. Joe Biden picks a Trump critic to head the Customs and Border Patrol. Good news, according to activists. However, Biden set to accept the fewest number of refugees ever. While everyone awaits a signed presidential determination to put in place what he claimed he was ordering weeks ago. Battle emerges between Pelosi in the House and Sanders in the Senate over whether to double down on the ACA or expand Medicare. Hunger strikes hit day 13. Over U.S. participation in the Yemen conflict. And amidst the Chauvin trial, another unarmed black man killed outside of Minneapolis. Lastly, congratulations, CEOs. Your pay surged in 2020. Everyone else's? Not so much. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Joining me, as always, she is back from her convalescence, Emma Vigeland. Emma, good to see you.
I didn't watch the show. I'm sorry. I was not feeling well on Friday. Did you mention why I was not feeling well?
To be honest with you, I can't remember. Okay.
I had some vaccine side effects. It's okay. I wasn't sure if I even wanted to share that because I don't want to discourage anybody, but it was well worth it. I will say.
Yeah. A lot of people have, don't feel so great on day, particularly after the day two shot. And that lasts, 24 hours, 36 hours in some cases, and so much better than getting COVID.
Right. Exactly. And so now, it was my second shot, in 14-ish days or now, I guess, around 10 days, I'll be fully protected or mostly protected. And that's an incredibly freeing feeling, I must say.
Yeah. And these side effects are, like I say, they're well known and not long term. And so, small price to pay. Sometimes you get a flu shot, you get a little red and swelling and maybe a little soreness. And this is a little bit more than that. And that's the soreness anyways.
And okay. Yeah.
Some people get like a little bit of a fever, but again, it is your body essentially training itself to react in many respects and practicing reacting to the potential of COVID coming by.
I remember the chickenpox vaccine. My brother got it, and he literally got minor chickenpox.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's like, what's the point? You still get it. But it's a much milder case. I do see right. the point.
Right.
Right.
And I don't think this is not akin to getting COVID. This is a reaction. Your body's sort of like play acting a reaction on some level if it had gotten COVID.
Yeah, it's a different breed of vaccine, which is it's not, you know, a little bit of the virus. It's the mRNA.
That's
technology, but I digress.
All right. Well, let's get into this. The we know that the Bessemer vote is under protest right now. The Bessemer vote that took place in Alabama, the attempt by some of the Amazon workers there to unionize, the union representing these folks have filed with the National Labor Relations Board a complaint that the election was not free and fair. There are multiple instances of, well, there are plenty of instances that we know of where Amazon spent millions of dollars in trying to discourage people to vote for the union. We also know that there were things that were sort of less within inside the bounds, and the bounds are very, very wide, in which they did, including putting a temporary ballot box on Amazon property, because they probably have data that shows that when you suggest for people to vote there, people who are voting against may feel more intimidated to vote against, or those who, you know, there may be a sense of like, hey, they're watching us. I get a vote, even if I'm sort of on the fence, et cetera, et cetera. But National Labor Relations Board is taking a look at that. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders made a point of giving a hat tip to those workers in Bessemer. Here he is.
Good to have you here. I was disappointed, but I was actually a little bit surprised that Amazon was so successful in its efforts. And I want to make that clear. This wasn't just workers who decided to vote on something. Amazon played a remarkable role, including requiring people to attend meetings and sort of intimidating them with the idea that if you unionize, our costs will go up and we may have to lay some of you off.
Look, Ali, you got to give enormous credit to the courage of the workers in Bessemer, Alabama. Here you are in an anti-union state. You are taking on one of the largest, most profitable corporations in the country, the wealthiest guy in the world. And you are living under terrible working conditions. I was down there. These people are monitored from the moment they get on the job. It is very hot. It is a huge facility. They got a half-hour break for lunch, and it takes them 10 minutes to walk to the break room. And all they wanted was the opportunity to sit down and negotiate better wages, better working conditions. And Bezos and the company spent a huge amount of money to defeat that effort. And that tells me that, among many other things, we need strong pro-labor legislation, which says that workers in America must have the constitutional right to form a union. And right now it is so difficult, whether it's Amazon, whether it is Walmart, whether it is any one of these large corporations, companies have so much power to threaten and intimidate, to put people into closed rooms and to tell them over and over again how terrible unions are. We've got to change that.
I want to ask you what model you use for that, because you talk about being in an anti-union state and the fact that so many companies are anti-union, but it doesn't have to be that way. If you look at Germany, for instance, union members have a seat at the board, so decisions don't tend to be made excluding workers. So you don't have this animus relationship between union members
That's right.
and workers versus the company. This is fixable.
Absolutely, and it's not only that in Germany workers are members of boards of large corporations. What we are seeing.
There you go. At the very least, there's some attention that's being paid to this. Obviously, Joe Biden mentioned organizing that was going on in Alabama. There's a lot of other, I think, failures by the union, frankly, in terms of this whole process. But we're going to probably get into that over the next week or two. as we look back on this, we get more information. But the bottom line is there needs to be a PRO Act that is going to protect workers, broadly speaking, where you don't need to have the strongest union, the most savvy union. You don't need to have you have a level playing field where you don't have to have a union going up against $25 million worth of a campaign that's being dropped on there, thousands per vote, practically.
Exactly. And you mentioned the USPS drop box from earlier in the show. And in doing some research on USPS for an interview I did last week, Amazon is its biggest client, or I think one of its biggest clients too. So there's that kind of relationship there where they were able to use their power and wield it in order to maybe tilt the scales. And that was just one of the many stories, changing traffic lights so yep. that Amazon union organizers couldn't canvass or talk to people as they drove into the facility. And the fact is that Alabama is as anti-union as it gets. So it was a difficult place to start, but the fight continues, of course.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Gabriel Winnett. He is an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago. He is the author of The Next Shift, Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare in Rust Belt America, as we talk more about unions and the dissolution of them and the power of workers. We'll be right back after this. Hey, folks, a couple of sponsors today. We all shop online, I imagine. It's particularly in this era, people are getting more and more used to it. I don't know, even know if it's a thing, right? To even say, of course, everybody shops online these days. And, back in the day, I used to spend a lot of time chasing promo codes, tried to instill this in my daughter so she was saving money. Well, but thanks to Honey, manually searching for coupon codes is a thing of the past. Honey is a free shopping tool. It scours the internet for promo codes, applies the best one that it finds, and applies it to your cart. Honey supports over 30,000 stores online, ranging from tech sites to gaming products to clothing brands. I always check out my Honey when I go to J. Crew to get my various colors of shirts that I have. When you check out, the Honey button drops down. All you have to do is click apply coupons. It takes a few seconds. It searches across for the best coupon to fit. And if Honey finds a working coupon, you watch as the price drops. Honey has found over 17 million members, over $2 billion in savings. Whenever J.Crew does not have a sale, I'm always saving a couple of bucks on Honey. Meanwhile, Mila just went back to her, what apparently seems to be her favorite site, Ulta, and she saved $4 on a $15 mask.
There you go. Oh, this is where she likes getting her serums.
It's apparently where she buys everything.
Yes, that's it's a good site. But
that's almost one third the price off that mask.
Yeah.
And I got news for you. The chances that my daughter is going to shop around for a coupon, forget about it. So she's psyched and I'm psyched. If you don't already have Honey, you could be straight up missing out on free savings. It's literally free, installs in a few seconds. By getting it, you'll be doing yourself a solid, supporting this podcast as well. I would, as you know, don't recommend anything I don't use myself. Or at least I have my daughter. She seems to be breaking that thing, going at it so hard, but that's I digress. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. Also, speaking of sponsors that I have used myself, you may not know this, but recent data shows that of all the female-owned businesses, it's estimated that 1 in 3 is owned by a mom. So do you ever wonder how these amazing moms, frankly, dads, find the time to hire for the businesses while juggling their families? ZipRecruiter. Right now, you can try it for free only at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. CEO and founder Talia Goldstein is one such mompreneur, I guess they're calling them. Besides being a mother of two, her personalized matchmaking company, 3-Day Rule, it's constantly growing. She needs to hire several matchmakers a month. So she uses ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's powerful technology helps her find people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply. Talia is not the only employer who loves ZipRecruiter. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter got to get a quality candidate within the first day. I am one of those. I'm a data paterner or whatever it is. And
fatherpreneur.
I think I had 2 children when I hired Brendan. They weren't in the office, but nevertheless, they're really psyched about it. Both my kids love Brendan. Anyways, right now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this web address, ziprecruiter.com/majority. The special offer is only good at ziprecruiter.com/majority. M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it is the smartest way to hire. And lastly, you've heard me talk quite a bit about Quip. It literally came up in a conversation I had the other day. It was a little bit strange to someone I just met very recently. And I couldn't help but start talking about Quip's amazing refillable flosser. I know that's weird. I know that's weird, but I'm sorry. I get excited about certain things. And
good
I have
the icebreaker.
Yeah, it's a great icebreaker, of course. Awesome. But here's the other thing. And my kids are loving this thing, too. And I carry this one around with me all the time. As you know, gum, the unsung hero when it comes to better oral health. Why? You got multiple dentists, including the ADA, that recommends chewing sugar-free gum for up to 20 minutes after meals. Cleans your teeth. Well, Quip reinvented the toothbrush. They revolutionized, as far as I'm considering, the reusable flosser. And now they've done it again for chewing gum. Quip's new chewing gum is actually good for your oral health. It comes with a dispenser that will remind you of the one-click candy you used to love as a kid. It's like a Pez dispenser, but it's actually better because it flies out. So you can literally do this and it pops into your mouth. It's the best way to carry around gum and not get like pant lint or whatever happening to it. Quip gum, of course, can prevent cavities, freshen your breath when chewed for 20 minutes after eating. It's sugar-free. It has tooth-friendly xylitol, 0 calories. It will definitely satisfy your taste buds. It's got a great mint flavor. It's got one of those crunchy tri-layer design type of things. But it's also no wrappers. And it's a great dispenser. And Quip also delivers fresh brush head, floss, and toothpaste refills every 3 months from $5. Shipping is free, so you can save money and skip the store. If you go to Quip, getquip.com/majority right now, you get a free plastic dispenser with any refill plan. That's free dispenser at getquip.com/majority. That's spelled GETQUIP.com/majority. Quip, the good habits company. All right. Want to welcome to the program assistant professor of history at University of Chicago, author of The Next Shift, The Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare in Rust Belt America. Gabriel Winnett, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So this is a, your book is in some part ethnography and in some part sort of a story of systems and really the rise and fall of two different types of economies and their relationship with each other. It really is fascinating. Let's just start with this and then we'll circle back around. Give us a sense of the healthcare economy in this country. We got $400 billion set aside in the infrastructure bill, ostensibly to deal with this sector of the economy. There's more to come, but give us a sense of just how big this is, because one of the things that your book reveals is also how little we seem to be aware of it.
Yeah. So healthcare has kind of eaten the economy over the last generation or two. And, you know, there are some ways that you and I might come across this in our daily lives and the costs we pay for care, right? How they've gone up or something. But I think you really see something amazing if you look at it in terms of employment. Healthcare is the biggest sector of employment in America now, 14% of all jobs in this country are in the category called healthcare and social assistance. And in particular, in big northern and Midwestern, formerly industrial cities, that number gets significantly higher. So my book is about Pittsburgh, where that number is like 18-19%, almost one in five jobs. In the Bronx, which of all urban counties in America has the highest level, it's 25%. And there are neighborhoods in parts of the Bronx, parts of Philadelphia, parts of Chicago, parts of Pittsburgh, parts of Detroit, places like this, where you'll see 35-40% of people working in healthcare and social assistance. So it's this huge, huge sector. It's exploded. And, you know, you think of healthcare and you think of doctors, maybe you think of, you know, RNs, registered nurses, but it's a major engine of low wage job growth. The fastest growing growing categories of jobs are things like nursing assistant, home health aide, jobs that are often paid $10, $11, $12 an hour.
So when we say when there's a high concentration of the economy in the Bronx is associated with that, that is not a coincidence that we're also talking the highest rates of people living in poverty and low income people.
Yeah. And you want to know why, you know, COVID has had this really horrible, uneven toll in terms of race, in terms of class. And think about what it means, right? That 25% of workers in the Bronx work in the healthcare industry. And that starts to give you your answer to that question.
Right. They're front line. And and they're theoretically meeting with people with COVID every single day.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go back and talk about Pittsburgh. And we should say, tell me why Pittsburgh, and what does Pittsburgh, how much does what happens in Pittsburgh also reflect what's happened, in what parts of the country?
Yeah, well, Pittsburgh is a neat case study of the kind of transformation that the whole, what we now think of as the Rust Belt, kind of went through. And you can see it literally on the physical skyline of the city. The tallest building in town is U.S. Steel Tower. It was built by U.S. Steel, once America's largest corporation, to be its headquarters. But the biggest tenant in U.S. Steel Tower is not U.S. Steel anymore. It's University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. So they took down the USS from on top of the skyline and put up UPMC. Like the whole city, right, has a different flag flying now. I chose Pittsburgh to study this process that I do think is general to similar kinds of cities, Cleveland, Detroit, again, Milwaukee, whatever, Buffalo, Rochester, because it was such a kind of classic case of a great American industrial city. If you go back to the Korean War or so, 1950, almost half of all jobs in Pittsburgh were industrial jobs. Steel, most of all, right? Steel is what we think of when we think of Pittsburgh. But, you know, mining and rail and warehousing and trucking and other kinds of manufacturing too, electrical work. And so Pittsburgh kind of exaggerates for us a process that the whole formerly industrial part of the country went through, if we look at how it changed.
And I should say some of it, I mean, you know, maybe I just tend to be central Massachusetts centric in my worldview. But I think there's some examples in Massachusetts, too. I would imagine there's throughout New England.
Worcester, Fall River, any kind of place like that.
Yep. I certainly recognize it from Worcester and maybe even arguably Lowell and a couple others. But the point being that this is a dynamic that's happened both Northeast and the Rust Belt to varying degrees in terms of their reliance on this. Okay, so give us a sense of the progression of what took place and what the nature of the jobs were when you were a steel worker, let's say, or one of these, you know, it could be you could have been working on an assembly line for cars too, on some level. But tell us what the dynamic was in that era.
Yeah, so I think now we have a tendency, especially political progressives, have a tendency to kind of romanticize this era, right? Because it's true that a steel worker or an auto worker would be making the equivalent of what's today, maybe $25, $30 an hour. You know, had much better health benefits than today, had much stronger unions than today. And so there's a reason that we look back with some nostalgia to the world of the blue collar worker in the middle of the 20th century. But, you know, what my book is trying to show is that there were things about these jobs that made them really brutal for people. You know, often industrial, factories ran 24 hours a day. Steel mills certainly did. And so that meant that very often maybe you were working night shifts, right? Or you're 1 week you're working night shift, next you're working day shifts. Injury rates, occupational hazard were really high. Everyone who spent a whole career in a steel mill saw people die. Horrible deaths, you know, had injuries themselves typically. And there's just an intense form of kind of alienation that came from, you know, being this kind of provider, breadwinner figure who had to kind of keep your family going, and knowing that this was a kind of honorable and heroic thing to do as everyone saw it, and yet feeling miserable all the time, right? And so again, a lot of people who work these jobs or whose dads work these jobs, I mean, they'll tell you about alcoholism and domestic violence and these kinds of things. It was not an easy life by any stretch. And underlying all of that, and this is the last thing I'll say about it, underlying all of that was the fact that it was gradually always falling apart economically. So that kind of work reached its peak in 1950. In 1960, it was smaller than it was in 1950. In 1970, it was smaller than it was in 1960, and on and on. And so even back in the golden age already, people were starting to wonder, God, how long am I going to be able to keep this job? You know, am I going to be, you know, full-time next week the way I was this week? There was insecurity always eating away at the edges.
And you gave us a sense of the proportions of how many, you know, people work in the healthcare sector now in these communities. What was that proportion like for, say, the steel industry back in the day?
Yeah, so in Pittsburgh in 1950, steel was about 20% of all jobs, so a similar level to healthcare around now. Manufacturing in general was more than that, but steel and metal production was about 20, which is very high, right? It's a very intense degree of specialization.
Right. I mean, every fifth person you're meeting, more or less, is associated with that. All right. So let's talk about what happened in terms of the development of healthcare. This story about Truman making, heading into to sort of pushing for universal healthcare and the unions creating what is the term? I mean, I want to say a trajectory, but like a determined path for where on some level, some of our, I guess our fate was sort of sealed here because unions were trying to just basically provide for these type of workers.
Yeah. So, you know, once a generation, this country has a fight over health insurance, basically at the political level. It happened in the 1910s. Nobody remembers that anymore. And it happened again in the 1940s when Truman was president. You know, and the war was over and they thought they were going to continue the New Deal, basically, right? They had established Social Security and unemployment insurance, and these kinds of things. And they turned their attention to healthcare, thinking this was next. And Truman's big kind of battalions of social support for doing this, his main social base, was the new industrial unions that at this time were really dynamic. They were growing. They were exciting. They were militant. People really identified with them. That's the United Auto Workers, the United Steel Workers, and United Electrical Workers, big unions of manufacturing workers, United Mine Workers. And, you know, a bunch of different factors came together to stop that from working out. Basically, they're trying to achieve what we would now call Medicare for All. And you could summarize it basically that the onset of the Cold War made that harder to do for various reasons that, you know, kind of the rising tide of anti-communism kind of beat back that effort.
Let me just stop you for one moment. So what's interesting is there was a ideological, almost, you know, not just a question of big entrenched interests at that point, but it was more of an ideological. Is that right? Or is it just that the big entrenched interests had an ideological as opposed to like sort of a political economy type of.
Well, there's both going on because the big entrenched interest in this time actually is the American Medical Association, who, you know, organized medicine today are actually much, much weaker than they were then. So it's hard to imagine doctors having this kind of sway. But organized medicine in the 40s was very strong and was very conservative and in alliance with a kind of anti-communist, you know, increasingly kind of McCarthyist politics, was able to beat this back. And, you know, the union movement itself was undergoing serious turmoil and, you know, increasingly internal conflict along the same lines, right? The mainstream unions were purging the left-wing unions and having these civil wars and things. And through all of this, the labor movement thought, you know what? we're going to keep our name on the paper saying we support Medicare for all, but seeing like it's probably not going to happen, let's get some health insurance out of our employers. And the auto workers and the steel workers and the miners all started pushing in the late 1940s for their employers to cover their members. And that basically is where employment-based health insurance comes from in this country. I mean, that's how it became a widespread phenomenon, was these unions built these private sector welfare states for their own members.
And this is like increasingly part of your story is about this sort of public-private welfare state that gets developed. That's also the case with prisons on some level too, I guess. So the you have now this private sort of welfare state that is developed because through union dues. And so what does that grow into, and then how does that relate to this story?
Yeah. So, you know, over the basically in the late 40s, they negotiate these plans, and over the 50s and 60s, these plans get good. I mean, you know, workers are on strike all the time in the 50s and 60s in the big industries, and their coverage starts to get, you know, it becomes something that you and I today would be like, oh my God, I've never seen anything like that. Folks who had parents who were in these industries will remember this. And, you know, they use the hell out of it, right? It's like, they have this really powerful kind of access to a certain kind of care. And very understandably, I think, you know, working class people are like, I can go to the hospital and they don't tell me to leave. I'm going to stay for 2 weeks. You know, I'm exaggerating it a little bit, but not by much. This, however, causes the costs of care to rise inevitably, right? You know, there's this booming working class market in industrial cities. Hospitals think we should expand. We should build a new wing. We should buy new equipment. We should jack up prices. As that happens, people who don't have in through their unions, they start to get priced out of the market. And in particular, if you think about who is that, right? It's not the wealthy because they can just buy their own access. What kind of working class people aren't going to have access? It's the poor and the unemployed who are kind of below the union standard. And it's the elderly who are retired and so are out of the workforce. So that leads to the pressure for Congress to pass Medicare and Medicaid in 1965. That's basically where that comes from. And once by the late 60s, you have Medicare and Medicaid and these private sector collectively bargained plans functioning together, you have this massive stream of income into the healthcare industry through what I'm calling the public-private welfare state. The other key part of this, so I was saying before, you know, they use the hell out of these plans, but in particular, I was mentioning earlier how, you know, every decade there are sort of fewer and fewer steelworkers. As a community goes through deindustrialization, it gets older, right? Young people sense that there's not going to be opportunity and they leave. And this big cohort of steelworkers you had in 1950 are approaching retirement. So the population getting older. As it gets older, it gets sicker, both because older people are sicker and also because laid off people are sicker. When you lose your job, you're likely to suffer health effects. And, you know, it's getting poorer. So older, poorer, and sicker together. However, they have this huge healthcare complex that's been built up to serve them. And that becomes one of the main points of access that people can kind of maintain to social services as other things are starting to fall apart economically.
Two points there. I want to get to the main point of access and sort of tease out what that means a little bit more, but in terms of like real world experiences. But this dynamic of what's also really interesting to me is this dynamic of the youth drain. That is a function of unions protecting seniority, and as these industries contract, young people are like, I don't have an opportunity here because I got in, I'm late to get in, so I'm going to leave. And so you have like a Pittsburgh that, I don't know, halves in its population or?
Yeah, Pittsburgh is less than half of its peak population today.
Wow.
And that's, you know, outside of New York City, which is about the same as it was in 1950, and obviously has other things going on that kind of keep the population up there. Most you know, most, I mean, I live in Chicago. Chicago is significantly smaller than it used to be. I grew up in Philly. Philly is significantly smaller than it used to be. And these are among the success stories, right, of deindustrialized cities. If you think about a Detroit or, you know, again, a Milwaukee or Buffalo or whatever, even smaller towns like Gary or Youngstown, you'll find places that are just tiny fractions of what they used to be.
Worcester, incidentally, actually increased its population by literally a few thousands from 1950. I don't understand that.
The Paris of the 80s.
Exactly. That's the that I still have that T-shirt. But the so that dynamic hits. I mean, what's interesting about this, too, is we should say, and I probably should have mentioned this at the top, is that when we think of healthcare economies, we imagine like Arizona or Florida or Nevada, right? Where theoretically old people move for retirement, but that's not the case.
Yeah. Right. So everyone always asks me, like, they hear what I study and they think, okay, well, that must be a story about these kinds of Sunbelt retirement communities. And it's true that they just don't register in the way that all these kinds of cities I'm talking about do at the level of healthcare employment. Because they're old, but they're not old the same way Pittsburgh is old. It doesn't mean the same thing that they're old, right? Because they're old because wealthier elderly people relocated there and, you know, brought all their resources with them. Pittsburgh is old because working class old people were stuck there.
And they have their jobs just took more of a toll on their bodies. And so what does that mean now that the hospitals at that juncture? And then I want to get into sort of like the disparity between like a community hospital and a research hospital. But what does it mean that it becomes a point of access? Like, is this like, does it replace like the VFW hall, or, I mean, like, what is it, or what happens there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to some extent, yes, people have these real meaningful social ties to their community hospitals. So if you go to one of these steel towns just outside Pittsburgh, Homestead, Braddock, McKeesport, this sort of ring of towns right around it where the mills were, you know, the giant steel mill would have been at the bottom of the town. They're all on a hill. And then basically across the street or maybe two blocks up, you would get to the hospital. And each town had one. And that, you know, the people who lived in that town and worked in that mill went to that hospital. And, you know, these were nonprofit private institutions, sometimes Catholic institutions or something like that. But people really felt like they kind of owned them. I like to tell a story, I tell a story in the book about Homestead Hospital in the 60s. You know, the population was shrinking. Not that many babies were being born because of the things we've just been talking about. And meanwhile, the main medical surgical parts of the hospital were overfull because they had all these well-insured old people. And so they said, let's close our obstetrics unit and, you know, turn it into medical surgical. And there's this outcry from the community of Homestead that our hospital has to be a place where babies can be born. There's an organization of women who volunteered photographing babies in the hospital, newborns, who bring a lawsuit and they win. This elected judge says, you know, I think it's significant that he's elected because it suggests there's kind of popular democratic power behind this. Says, no, actually the hospital has to be a place where babies can be born. If you want to, you know, rewrite your charter and become a different kind of organization, feel free. But until you do that, you have to keep that unit open. And I think that's a kind of good example of how people really feel like they have some ownership over these institutions. They have surprisingly kind of deep relationships to them.
And it's also the accountability that the hospital had to the community. I mean, it's whether, you know, that they couldn't just pursue profits at that time.
Right.
However, yeah,
their nonprofit status actually kind of meant something.
Right. However, what happens as we sort of move forward with the type of care? Like we get this disparity between what's happening at the sort of the research hospitals and like Homestead, these community hospitals.
Yeah. So, you know, first there's this period, basically the 1970s into the 1980s, when economically Pittsburgh has fallen apart and the hospitals are just doing great, including these kind of smaller community hospitals, because they can feed on this economic displacement, right? People are losing their income, are losing other sources of security, but they're old and they're sick and they have good insurance and they go to the hospital for a lot of different things. And so these are like the boom years for even these community hospitals. But, you know, as this process starts to play out nationwide into the early 80s, it means that the healthcare system is growing and growing and growing in a moment when the rest of the economy, particularly in industrial centers, is kind of contracting pretty sharply. And health inflation is taking off even after the Fed has started to really deflate the economy starting in 1979. So Congress gets worried about healthcare costs. And in 1983, changes the rules for how Medicare reimburses hospitals. This sounds boring. It's actually incredibly important.
It's not boring to me. I've been waiting for to get to this okay. Prescriptive billing versus retroactive billing.
So up till 83, from 65 to 83, the way Medicare paid hospitals was the hospital did whatever they did, you know, and then they sent the federal government a bill saying, okay, this cost us this much. Give us 102% of that. And it meant that they couldn't lose money, right? They were going to have a positive margin on. So that's called retrospective reimbursement, right? Congress said, okay, we got to impose some market discipline, some competition on these hospitals. So they are like eating our lunch. So they switch it to what's called prospective payment, where the federal government writes up a list of, you know, several hundred possible diagnoses and says, here's what we're going to pay you for each of them. You pick what the patient has a diagnosis of and, you know, with some adjustments for regional labor costs and things like that. That's what you're getting. You can keep them for a day. You can keep them for a month. You can spend however much you want. That's up to you. You're working off a fixed price sheet. And this causes this big shakeout in the hospital industry over the course of the 80s and into the 90s. Basically, the big academic and research hospitals that have a lot of capacity for doing technologically or scientifically kind of complex interventions here in Pittsburgh, the classic case is transplants. They do great, actually. Their margins go up because, you know, this new system rewards sort of very costly diagnoses. However, the institutions like Homestead Hospital that had been doing great on basically being semi-nursing homes for years, they, you know, that model doesn't work at all anymore. And those institutions all go under over the course of about 10 years after this reform and get snapped up by, get bought up by the big academic medical centers. So that's how you get a UPMC that I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. The big university hospital buys all the distressed community ones and takes up market share. That then, we can get into this if you want, that then kind of sets off this complicated dynamic sort of arms race between insurers and hospitals you may recognize from the 90s, the managed care stuff.
Well, yeah, this is fascinating. Okay, I'm sorry. I just wanted to just note, like, there's that piece that I cite a couple of times a year, it seems like, Atul Gawande's piece on the two Texas towns and the cost of Medicare, those guys with the heavy equipment are charging a lot more because they're finding specific diagnoses that they can treat that are just more expensive care. I'm just doing, you know, the and that's sort of distorts things. Go ahead, Emma.
Yeah, we moved on from that, you mentioned I think you mentioned something about nursing homes, because I wanted to ask you how the increase in nursing home patients and the rise of the nursing home industry played into this dynamic in the 80s.
Yeah, thanks for asking that. That's a key piece of this. So, you know, once these community hospitals get destabilized in this way, and I said they were kind of functioning as informally as nursing homes, basically, actual nursing homes and also home care agencies realize that there's a market opening for them, right? They can provide this kind of long-term care, labor-intensive care, right? As opposed to the capital-intensive care that they're doing in hospitals, without having to actually invest in all that, you know, plant and equipment and stuff. This has always been the kind of predatory, you know, like the real bottom feeders of the industry. This is really where you find them. They realize they can finance most of their expansion with public money The public will subsidize almost any capital expansion in this industry. So they borrow using public subsidy. All of their income comes from Medicare and Medicaid. And they set up shop really rapidly over the course of the 80s and 90s, getting elderly people into nursing homes and to some extent into home care.
And okay, and so we're left with this now, this dilemma, and the theme that runs through all this is essentially that all the jobs we've created this sort of medical industry, which in some respects is good, it's not necessarily organized the way we'd want it, but these behemoths are making massive amounts of profit and are able to just basically. Part of it is just by consolidating and then keeping wages low, right? I mean, that seems to be the big dilemma that we have. In fact, I think at one point you call it a trilemma. What is that trilemma?
Yeah, so the trilemma is something that's faced by all kinds of deindustrializing kind of, wealthier societies around Europe and the United States. And basically it's that, when you trade industrial jobs for service economy jobs, you lose the dynamic in the industrial economy that allowed for everybody to kind of win at the same time somewhat, right? Which is a productivity increasing, basically steady productivity increases over time meant that employers could make money, but workers could also have pretty steady wage increases. And there was a kind of compromise that was possible through that. And that's what, when we think of the 50s and 60s, that's what we're thinking of. When you trade that out for the service economy, you lose the basis of that compromise, because most service industry jobs, healthcare jobs, for example, you can't really increase productivity per hour in any similar kind of way. Or if you do, you're doing it at the cost of the quality of the service itself.
Right.
So that sets up these more zero-sum choices, so long as you're like, in a capitalist society that, organizes survival and work in certain ways. And these zero-sum choices, the idea of a trilemma isn't mine. It comes from political scientists, but I'll just describe it quickly. Basically, policymakers can choose two out of three things that they want. They want high wages, they want low unemployment, and they want low public spending. And they can have any two of those three is the idea. But you can't have all three because one is going to cut against another in some form. So the U.S. has chosen the route of low unemployment, low wages, and low public spending, relatively. And that means that we've done better than Europe in terms of unemployment, actually. But we've proliferated these jobs that, like I said, people can't really survive on, even though we depend on them to take care of us.
So the outcome of that, being able to sort of find that comfortable place that supposedly creates some type of like political equilibrium, is that there's just a lot of people living on less money than they really need to live, essentially.
More and more every year in this industry. And again, we really depend on them. I mean, that's the irony of it.
You spoke about the different moments where we had these healthcare battles, right? And it sounds like a little bit of like what happened during Truman also happened during the ACA fight, which is like all we're doing, or I should say with Medicare and Medicaid in 65, all we're doing is we're looking at where the gap is and how can we fill that without having to expand government's role in that in the most minimal way possible. Right. And so it's like, we're just going to cover people 65 and older. And, maybe at that time it's like, and people don't make it to 65 so much. In Medicaid, we're going to put a threshold where it's really low. And so it's not really going to serve, the number of people that we need it. The ACA expanded that threshold. And now we're sort of, one of the headlines I read today was just Pelosi and Sanders are going to fight over an expansion of that ACA or Medicare, drop the Medicare age down to like 50, 55 or something to that effect. But what can we do about the wage end of it?
Well, I mean, the problem here is that this kind of nibbling around the edges dimension of it is really connected to the wage problem. Because, you know, really, I mean, the story I've been telling you this last half hour is about how the public created the healthcare industry to meet our needs. We did a lot of it through the private sector, right? But it's public policy, it's politics that created the healthcare industry. However, we subcontracted it, basically, right? I mean, that's more or less what happened. We created this thing and we subcontracted it. And that means that these millions and millions of workers, I mean, we all know what a subcontractor has to deal with, right? They're sort of informal public employees. And that means that nibbling around the edges of the healthcare system, the way Obamacare did, the way even Medicare and Medicaid did, while leaving this monolith of private administration and ownership intact, is going to keep the wage problem there in some form. We can do things about it. You know, we can support workers' unionization. We can regulate staffing levels more than we do. I'm not saying there's nothing to do, but and those are really important. You know, they're the first things that workers or the unions in this industry will say to you. But so long as the federal and state governments subcontract responsibility for this basically public service to the private sector, the private sector is going to make money the one way it can, or one of the two ways it can, right? Which are gouging the patient and driving down the wages of the worker. Those are the only ways they have to make money.
Right. They're arbitraging the money that's coming in from these unions or the federal government and the state government, and just making sure their costs are lower so that they can put money into their pockets. I know you've got a hard out. I could talk about this for a long time. It's a really fascinating book. Gabriel Winant, historian from the University of Chicago. The book is The Next Shift, The Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare in Rust Belt America. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We had a little bit of a late start today, and so I would have loved to have gone another couple of minutes with him. My apologies on that, folks, but maybe we will revisit. I'm going to, you know, in the near future. He is a, and I should say that Winant was a union organizer, I think, at one point, and he has another book, too. Maybe we should have him on for that as well, as a way of justifying having him return. But in the meantime, we will take a quick break. And when we do, we will return after that break. We're back, folks. This fight that is going to take place, and really is begun, as to whether we double down on the Affordable Care Act or expand Medicare is going to be a real crucial one in terms of structural things. Nancy Pelosi, an avowed opponent of single-payer healthcare, apparently also just an avowed opponent of expanding Medicare.
Well, because when you do that, that could lead the way to single-payer healthcare.
It is, and you're covering more people under a single-payer healthcare plan. And
it makes it clear, why don't we just expand this to everybody?
it starts to make you wonder, doesn't it? Because also remember, we also, you know, we have S-chip programs, but we could expand those and make those more. We could expand coming from both directions in terms of ages. Pelosi wants to make permanent the temporary expansion of the Affordable Care subsidies included in the $1.9 trillion stimulus legislation last month. Sanders is arguing for lowering the age of Medicare eligibility to 55 or 60 and expanding the program for seniors so it covers dental, vision, and health care. Remember, the expansion of the ACA, there's two parts of it. There are subsidies in the private exchanges that go a little bit higher in terms of who gets those subsidies, as opposed to just cutting at 400% of poverty. There's also the expansion of Medicaid, which I don't know if it is necessarily a function of the ACA. Don't know that those would have to necessarily be trade-offs. But reminder, the ACA, it applies to, I don't know, 10, 11 billion Americans. We've had 500,000 more sign up as of late. 10 or 11 million Americans does nothing to control the cost of healthcare, does nothing to make our system more sort of like cohesive or logical in any fashion whatsoever. So that is a bit of a problem in terms of running a healthcare system. Part of what we're seeing in this infrastructure is an expansion, $400 billion, heading towards healthcare. And there are some, like infrastructure expert Chris Christie, who understands the real value of infrastructure, folks.
Yes, he loves those bridges, right?
Oh, you know? He also has a thing for tunnels, but we'll talk about that in a moment as well. Here is Chris Christie. He is on George Stephanopoulos's program, ABC The Week. And here he is basically just flacking the Republican talking point.
You cannot call a $400 billion plan to force unionization in states to say that taking care of increasing Medicaid payments in states is infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Now, language does matter. We learned that in the last 4 years, how you use it and what you say. And I said last week that the president's not telling the truth, and he's not telling the truth about the infrastructure package. This is the care economy. This is care infrastructure. It's baloney. And so what's going to happen is the president right now is in the first 100 days, and he's going to have that soothing persona and all the rest of it. But when people start to look at what he's really doing, George, those moderate voters.
But even the things you just mentioned right there are popular. People would love to have Medicaid increase.
They would like their grandparents to be taken care of.
So here's what's not popular. Lying is not popular. It's not infrastructure, George.
Interesting.
You really want to use the word lie there?
If Donald Trump, let's just be fair here. If Donald Trump had come out and called a dog a cat, which is what Joe Biden's doing, we would be outraged by the fact that he's lying. But with Joe Biden, somehow it's like, oh, well, come on, it's Joe. No. It's not true. If he wants to make the case, George, for increased Medicaid payments and connected to those payments, mandatorily using SEIU union members, let him make that case and see if he gets it passed. I know he won't. And the people around this table, whether they'll say it or not, they know it won't pass either. Great.
Look at the state of the Republican Party's talking points against this infrastructure package. This very popular idea doesn't technically meet the definition that we're ascribing to it as infrastructure. So yeah, he's a liar. Let's scrap it all together. I mean, when Chris Christie said lying is not popular, one, Chris Christie, known liar, two, he was a top surrogate for the biggest liar in the history of American politics. So it seems like the American people aren't as concerned with the lying aspect because, shocker, every politician lies. It doesn't matter who they are. They're a little bit more concerned with what is going to improve their lives, not the definition of infrastructure as the Republican Party wants to prescribe it, not the lying about it aspect. They are very much more concerned with what's in the bill.
I think it's a really super weak, you know, you got to do a three-step dance here for this, right? I mean, Marsha Blackburn tried step number one with her her big meme, $400 billion towards elder care, as if this is supposed to scare people.
Right.
You know, it's anything but infrastructure, $400 billion towards elder care.
Very scary font.
We wouldn't want care for our elderly. We don't want to include that as infrastructure. First off, it is the care economy. We just had someone on the program describing how much of our economy is dominated by healthcare, and it is going to continue in that manner. Part of the reason why it's made so invisible is because people don't want to pay for it in any way. And there's so much profits being made by these hospital organizations over it. But this is a guy who, you know, if infrastructure, understanding the dynamics of infrastructure is so important, this is a guy who refused the stimulus money in 2010, 2009, to build that other tunnel under the Hudson River. And it's become extraordinarily more costly now just to do it 10 years later. And it's going to have to, you know, it's happening. You need it. And he refused to do it. So, I mean, it's just the idea that this is going to fly, this notion of trying to gin up anger against infrastructure, it is really, it's going to be tough. Now, with that said, they were mad about the Affordable Care Act because of how many pages were in it. And that had some resonance. But I just don't think that people are going to be out there going, Joe Biden's a liar, because his definition of elder of infrastructure includes creating a context in which people can get care as they're older. That doesn't seem to me to be something that is going to,
yeah,
in those Trump rallies, it's just not going to resonate.
This is a real grasping at straws moment. I mean, everything since Biden has come into office, the right has had zero idea as to how to attack him, and they haven't found their footing yet. And this is just another example of it, in my view.
Well, that's it for us today, folks. We will be back tomorrow with more, as tomorrow is Tuesday and today is Monday. So that's the way it works around here. Don't forget, if you missed any part of this program, you can check it out at 10 p.m. on the Peacock app on the Choice channel. Also, you can see the extra interviews Emma and I do at 5 p.m. on the Peacock app. And for those of you sticking around, you can see us right now.
You are looking at us or listening, potentially.
Yes, indeed. I just got an IM, unemployed Zoomer. Fantastic interview today. What term would you use to describe the type of history that Gabriel Winnett is working within?
American history?
I don't know. This is like one of those, it's an annoying question, because I could come up with like, labor history, American history. Is he looking at it through sort of like a Marxist analysis of the economy? Is it? I can't tell if that's just sort of
somebody that involves your clever. Favorite kind of thing, definitions.
Well, it's just
I'm being sarcastic.
I know. Yeah. Just say what you want to say. I find that type of
there's
question.
Power in taxonomy, Sam.
Yeah, I get, that's the thing that I find so annoying about it.
We can ask him and see what he says too.
We can, but it's also like the answer to that question, the subtext of the answer to that question is whatever will limit who's willing to hear this. That's what, like, when you insist on this taxonomy. And this is almost like the same issue I had with Sanders, you know, opening his campaign with sort of defining
or wanting to teach people about democratic socialism. It's like there's no political value in that as a political tool, at least in terms of a retail tool. Like, I understand the value of it amongst like sort of closed systems, right? I understand the value of that taxonomy. But in the context of something that's going to go out and try and convert people, anytime you use a taxonomy, a label for it, you're just, the only benefit that you're going to get is, well, there is no benefit. The only possible implication of that is that you will either have no impact on how that message is received, or you will diminish the ears that are willing to hear it. There is no increase. There is no increase. And that's why I find I don't have a problem with it in the context of, like, you know, people have discussion. I find those conversations, frankly, interesting, but it's why I don't engage in them, because that's not what I'm doing here. I'm not trying to convert people to a specific ideology that is defined by, that is, you know, the definition of which is in constant flux or argument. I am trying to get them to subscribe to a very broad worldview through different policies and make them see certain worldviews without having to have it named. Other people can name it. It's just not interesting to me. So don't forget to smash that like button, says Chardonnay Socialist.
Smash it.
Folks, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you also support, you also get the fun half, and you get the free show free of commercials. So why would you not do this? Also, link and subscribe to our YouTube channel or to our Twitch channel. You can subscribe over there. Poggers, we got a bunch of great emojis over at our Twitch channel. So check that out. Don't forget AM Quickie, amquickie.com. Get your morning headlines, and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Does anybody know who's on Nomi's show? Oh, it's today's Monday, so nobody's on Nomi's show. But check out Nomi. She'll be back live tomorrow at the Noma Key show, or youtube.com/the Noma Key show. Matt, what's happening in the Lekian media empire?
Yeah, workers are still organizing, folks. We talked to Nathan Bernard about Maine nurses and the liberal union buster that's coming up to try to stop them from organizing and make them feel heard. So check that out on Thursday.
Is there a vote going on right now in Maine?
Yeah, it's going on right now, and it wraps up at the end of the month.
April 29th, correct? Yep.
That's okay. Correct.
It's all going to be, like I say, healthcare, I think, is just such a huge, this ultimately is the battlefield. And both in terms of, like, you know, how we're going to pay people and how we're going to care for people. And also the after food, I guess in shelter too, on some level. I don't know how you would parse that out, but healthcare, so crucial, to both, helping workers and, you know, who are actually involved in healthcare, having a single payer healthcare system, and also in terms of helping workers who are not, involved in the healthcare system. I mean, just taking that off the table is going to give workers a lot more, I think, bargaining power. And it's going to be hard to sort of, like, to work this with unions, right? I mean, because unions, one of their big selling points have been for 50 years, 60 years, 70 years. 70 years has been one of its selling points has been its healthcare, what it provides in terms of healthcare. So, all right, folks. Going to head into the fun half of the program, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number.
Yeah.